Almost 6 hours into the mission, Akira was sitting on a supply crate somewhere deep under the crater of Megacity Tokyo. Kichiro and Akami were standing behind him, watching the three raiders that had ambushed them. The person that had been wearing the gas mask turned out not to be a man after all, but rather a girl named Hina. The gas mask hung around her neck as she held a rag up to her busted nose to soak up the blood. Their leader, Aiji, had taken off his docking cap and was rubbing his bald head. The third guy who had tried to tie up Kichiro and Akami was a middle-aged man named Lee. All three of them watched Akira suspiciously as they ate energy bars he had brought. He figured a peace offering wasn't a bad thing. He wasn't sure how they had survived, but it gave him hope that there were more like them, especially this close to the crater. Although he doubted they lived anywhere close, Akira had considered sending Okami out to recon the tunnels, but didn't want to get separated in the underground labyrinth.
We should keep moving.
Aiji stuffed the rest of his energy bar into his torn jacket. He then pulled out his flashlight, turned it on, and directed it down the passage. Most of the earthen corridor seemed to have been made post-E-Day. They were plenty big enough for Kichiro, who walked behind the group. Okami went over to the wall and sniffed at a black, sappy material. He let out a whine and then turned away, running ahead. The tunnel ended at a collapsed wall that provided only a narrow passage into a subway.
Stay here.
Aiji pushed night vision goggles over his eyes, looked through the hole, then hopped through. As soon as he was gone, Hina turned to Akira.
You came to find a life arc?
Akira nodded.
Why? Are there people there? Are there survivors like us?
Maybe.
Of course there are. But we're from outside the walls, which means we don't matter.
So you came to save the other people? What about our people?
Our people aren't valuable. This guy didn't care about us before E-Day. What makes you think he would now?
The words stung Akira, but they were true in a way. And yet part of Akira's ethos was to protect civilians, no matter where they came from.
I'll do what I can to help you all. You have my word.
The tap of footsteps echoed through the tunnel. Aiji must have been headed back.
I don't trust him for shit.
A slight vibration tremored through the ground. It was so faint that no one else seemed to notice. Aiji reemerged further down the subway tunnel, waving.
Follow me.
Let's go.
She and Lee squeezed past Akira onto the tracks. He jumped out after them and then motioned for Kichiro. The horse scraped his sides against the crumbled wall, barely squeezing through. Another rumble vibrated across the tracks as if a train was coming. Okami growled.
Hey. I feel something.
Aiji stopped.
What do you mean?
A vibration.
Hina and Lee were already moving before Aiji waved them onward. It was obvious they knew what was making the weak quakes, and now was not the time to stop and discuss it. Aiji led them into another opening that seemed wide enough for Kichiro. Akira kept his rifle up as they entered the darkness of another passage with walls of damp soil. Not far down, he saw it connected to a large underground chamber. It looked to be a basement of an old building. In the middle of the room, a sinkhole had devoured part of the floor. There was no way around the chasm, and Akira couldn't quite see how deep it was. Aiji ran and jumped over it, landing on the other side and continuing on. Lee went next. For Akira, it was an easy jump, but Hina hit the edge and began to cartwheel her arms, tilting backward into the abyss. Akira snagged her before she could fall into the dark hole, and she righted herself.
Thanks.
Kichiro and Akami both leapt across next. Kichiro landed heavily, his hooves sending out a quake of their own. As if in answer, another large tremor shook the room. Dust and grit rained from the ceiling, and the cracked concrete walls shook.
We gotta move faster.
On the way across the room to another door, Akira heard what sounded like distant human screams.
Hey, wait! There are more people out there!
Aiji was already leading the way down into a stairwell.
No, there aren't.
I heard screaming.
There aren't people.
And what is it?
Monsuta. Monsters.
The screaming rose into a jarring chorus. Kichiro ducked into the stairwell, scraping the narrow walls. The same tar-like substance Akira had seen in the other tunnels stuck to the concrete, clinging like glue. Akira followed Kichiro closely, looking back up the stairs as the screams chased them. The stairs ended at a T-intersection in the corridor. Aiji darted to the left. When Akira reached the T and made it around, Aiji was stopped at a railing around a drop-off. A pool of dark water lay below, its surface rippling from the quakes.
Hope your droids can swim.
What?
We have to jump.
It's the only way to escape.
Akira turned as the unholy screams resonated from back up the stairwell. A thunderclap shook the ground and walls around them.
Jump!
Akira leaned over the railing and hit the water with a tremendous splash. He kicked for the surface just as Hina hurtled over the railing and into the water, followed by Lee. Akira shouldered his rifle and twisted back toward the wailing. The horrifying din grew louder and louder with every second. A glowing red light emerged at the entrance to the stairwell. Scraping metal pierced the clamor of the screeches. Akira moved his finger to the trigger as a thick tube of metal slithered around the corner, leaving a trail of tar. He aimed it where the head should have been, but instead there were five human faces covered in gashes, squirming on the front of a skull. Bulging eyeballs honed in on Akira's droids. He whistled right before he squeezed the trigger. Okami jumped over the railing with Kichiro, both plunging into the water as he provided covering fire. The plasma bolts tore into the agonized human faces as each abomination exploded in a spray of gore. Akira knew that there was only one explanation. They were yet another science experiment created by Dr. Otto Cross for his new hellish world. An asteroid streaked over the lunar sky, burning over the sprawling basin. Ronan trekked across the lonely gray stretch with the 28 other machine slayers. The platoon had a perfect view of Earth during their evening patrol. The planet, still burning from E-Day, appeared as a brownish-red ball out in space. Ronan and a few other cadets stopped to watch it disappear as night fell over Earth. An alert from Sergeant Slaner sounded over comms.
Keep moving! We're heading back to base!
Ronan turned back toward their new home, since a pair of King Cobra space planes were burning across the black overhead. Ronan stopped and watched them as the third fighter joined the formation. It wasn't unusual to see them on air patrols, but it was odd to see them dip into Kepler Crater. Ronan looked across the regolith to see Sergeant Zlaner, who tilted his head like he was getting a private comms message. Then he waved for the platoon to move forward.
Back to the station! Now! Repeat, back to station!
Ronan didn't waste a second, breaking into a loping run. Ronan almost stopped when he saw the cannon barrels built into nearby ridgelines rotating toward the abyss of space. Across the crater, flashes erupted from the distant cannons built along the edges.
Behind us!
Ronan turned to a view that nearly made him stumble with shock. An entire swarm of 30 praying mantis fighters rose over the basin. They must have flown low over the moon's surface to attack the station. This was it. This was the day the machines finally attacked the moon. And the Machine Slayer platoon was caught in the open.
Oh no!
Some of the cannons built into the crater rim began to rotate toward them, while the others focused on firing at more praying mantis fighters coming from Earth's direction. Plasma fire tore overhead, but the bolts weren't meant for the platoon. The shots slammed into the towers and structures at Kepler Station. Massive explosions ripped the defensive emplacements apart. Ronan looked off to the left to see a different platoon was already running for cover. The praying mantis fighters turned their turrets on the troopers. Geysers of rock exploded into the air along with chunks of burning flesh and broken armor. As the debris came back down to the ground, Raiders pockmarked the regolith filled with blood and gore. Ronan kept running, helplessly watching the aerial battle. Back at the main base, two moths pulled away from the runway. They rocketed toward the central command tower. A few praying mantis fighters swooped in after the transports. They launched a salvo of missiles that speared into the wings and hulls. The heavy armor gave way, and the pilots lost control, both of the moths going down. A single praying mantis fighter launched another missile right at the center of the main tower. 2 seconds later, the entire command center disappeared in a black cloud of debris that even consumed the enemy craft. Ronan stopped next to Zlaner, both watching in horror.
Sergeant, what do we do?
Zlaner lowered his rifle, clearly in shock. The rest of the platoon huddled around, taking knees as enemy fire pounded the base. Ronan put a hand on Zlaner's shoulder plate, shaking him out of his trance. The sergeant finally turned and looked over the basin. He pointed to a ridgeline along the crater rim.
Fall back to those bunkers!
The entire platoon ran as fast as their exoskeletons would allow, but Ronan feared it wouldn't be fast enough before the praying mantis fighters returned to catch them in strafing fire. Ronan risked a glance over his shoulder to see another lookout tower at Kepler Station toppling over, crashing in a heap of debris.
Watch out!
Blue lights broke out through the darkness like winking stars along the crater rim about 2,000 feet to their left. It took Ronan another second for his brain to register what those stars really were. segmented arms whipped above the crater rim, pulling up 600-pound machines into the basin.
Halt! Engage the enemy! Repeat, engage the enemy! Free fire! Free fire!
Some of the cadets fled in panic, but Ronan stood his ground with Mickey, Bradley, and a dozen others. The shoulder-mounted cannons on the canebrakes exploded to life, bolts coursing through the darkness and tearing into the cadets.
Behind us!
Krang Mantis fighters ripped toward their rear flank, hammering the ground with missiles. One blast tore Ronan off his feet, throwing him onto his back. His helmet screamed a warning, and his HUD flickered a message. Critical damage to battery. Ronan's HUD suddenly shut off. Blinking, Ronan looked up to see the swarm of Krang Mantis fighters soared away from the basin and Kepler station, headed straight toward Mesopotamia, for Elan, for their mother, and for all the survivors. Ronan then pushed himself up, grabbed his rifle, aimed at the army of approaching machines, and opened fire. The machines charged, whipping their arms out and firing blades at Ronan and the others. One of those blades ripped into his suit.
No!
Ronan jerked awake, covered in sweat and sat upright. Chest heaving, he slowly turned in his cot to see the other cadets he had just seen die sleeping peacefully in their bunks across the barracks. Ronan tried to control his breath as he laid back down and rested his head back on his pillow, but he didn't close his eyes. This nightmare had haunted him every time he tried to sleep lately. Each time the machines ambushed the LDC, overwhelming and destroying the base with ease. And the moving on to Mesopotamia. He was sure the LDC had a way to safeguard the secret location if Kepler Station did fall, but if Ronan had learned anything about the machines, it was that they were relentless. Once they overwhelmed Kepler, they would be impossible to stop. His brother, mother, and everyone else would be slaughtered.
Ronan?
He looked over to find Bradley in the next cot, was awake.
Nightmare?
Just a dream about the machines. Just can't sleep. You?
Still fired up about weapons training. I didn't think I had it in me.
Hey, shut up, will ya?
Ronan looked back to the ceiling.
Go to sleep. You're gonna need your rest. We got patrol on the basin tomorrow.
Ronan closed his eyes, hoping for sleep this time.
Ronan, in your dream, when the machines came, did we win?
Yeah, we won.
Tig stood in the cargo hold of their stealth moth with Keanu, Cyrus, Chloe, and the team of rebel troopers. Their journey from the Shoemaker Crater to Kepler Crater had gone by uneventfully. The fact that the stealth moth had evaded Kepler's defense bothered Tig. If a ragtag crew like theirs could get this close to Kepler Station, he wondered how easy it would be for the machines. They were still 50 miles from the actual station and would take a transport train to close the final distance. Uneventful was okay for now, but soon it was going to be anything but uneventful. Getting Captain Jake Harback out of prison, not to mention getting to Earth in one piece, would be no cakewalk. But for Tig, finding Shadow Squad and destroying Dr. Otto Cross and every enemy machine was worth risking his life. He was ready for the fight, but he wasn't sure Chloe was ready for where they were headed. The girl spoke like she was ready, and she had gone through hell during the occupation of Megacity Paris and at Atlas Station. But surviving hell didn't always prepare someone to fight and kill. If Chloe stood any chance of succeeding at this next mission, she had no choice but to become a warrior. Cyrus, love-struck as he might be with Chloe, still had a tough streak. The guy was a former police officer, and Tig could tell Cyrus would go down fighting to save Chloe. Tig hoped it wouldn't come to that. Tig raised one of his new arms under trooper armor to get the attention of his new friends.
Oi! You know, in Shadow Squad, we used to have a saying. The crazier the plan, the better chance of success, because no one will see it coming.
Maybe that works for engines. But in case you forgot, we sure as hell aren't engines.
Keanu canted his head to Tig, then nodded at Cyrus.
The plan might sound crazy, but it's solid. My allies have arranged safe transport to Kepler via a train transport. Once you reach the station, two Allied troopers will be waiting to help you free Captain Harback.
Allied?
Yes. We can trust them. These are defectors like Cyrus.
If Keanu says we can trust them, we can. However, you think Tig's gonna just walk around without anyone noticing?
But according to the LDC, he's dead. Tig is the last person anyone's going to be looking for right now.
The Moth's troop-hold speaker offered a squawk and a two-tone alert.
Prepare for landing.
Chloe then looked to Keanu.
I'm more worried about you.
I'll be fine. I've already got friends waiting for me. Now, everyone, get ready. Once we land, we'll need to move fast.
Better say your goodbyes, then.
Chloe embraced her uncle for a long moment, then broke the embrace, but stayed close.
Everything's going to be okay. We'll see each other again, one way or another.
You really think we can do this? Stop Dr. Cross, save Earth, and protect the colonies?
I believe in destiny, and I believe Apeiron picked you because of your strength and your intelligence. Now go find her.
I will. I won't let you down.
Chloe stepped back from her uncle, and Keanu offered a hand to Tig.
Good luck, Sergeant.
Tig met Keanu's hand with one of his new robotic limbs.
Good luck, Counselor.
Behind him, Chloe, Cyrus, Keanu, and the rebels that had accompanied them made their final preps for landing, putting on helmets and securing their suits. A few minutes later, the Moth sat down with a jolt. Once the troop hold opened, Tig stepped down the ramp and jumped out onto the moon. Tig scanned the terrain of rolling dunes, seeing no sign of hostiles. Cyrus swept past and led the way to a utility hatch protruding from one of those dunes. It was the same kind the LDC had installed throughout the crater, ones that Tig knew were now all protected by cameras, alarms, and sensors. Keanu followed Cyrus across the surface to a hatch that looked a lot like a manhole cover. Cyrus opened it, and they began the descent down a ladder into a utility tunnel. Tig went first with his plasma pistol in one hand for whatever awaited them. At the bottom, he used his tactical light to clear a long tunnel. He switched to his rifle. Once they were all down, they started walking through the dark tunnel. They traversed the eerie darkness, listening and watching for any sign that they'd been spotted. Finally, they came upon another door. Keanu squeezed past Tig and then tapped it several times. Cyrus moved in front of Chloe, and Tig did the same with his rifle raised. He moved his finger to the trigger, ready to blast any troopers that might have sniffed them out. Sure enough, there was a person waiting when the door opened. Tig kept his barrel pointed at a man wearing a black vacuum-rated suit. Keanu walked ahead, raising a hand as if to say it was all right. The man in the black suit took a step back and gestured for the group to go through an open hatch into a chamber. After closing the hatch, he tapped a control panel and the room pressurized. Tig's HUD flashed an update of breathable air and artificial Earth-like gravity. The next hatch opened to another utility tunnel, but this one was wide enough for vehicles. They stepped through the hatch and into the tunnel. Standing about 20 feet away was an LDC trooper armed with a rifle. A large bag was at his feet. Tig halted, squaring up with his barrel on the mirrored visor of the trooper. The man in the black suit then raised the visor of his helmet to reveal a bald head and bushy brown eyebrows.
He's a friend.
Keanu lifted up his visor with a smile.
Gentry, I knew you would keep your word.
The two men embraced in a short hug. Gentry then pointed to the soldier.
This is Sergeant Locke. He's on our side.
Tig lowered his rifle, but kept his eyes on the trooper.
This way. We don't have much time before the next patrol.
Locke picked up his bag and started to walk the opposite way down the corridor, and the whole team followed. Tig was impressed at the counselor's ability to get them this far, but every person that knew about them was one more person that could fry this whole mission. Tig thought back to Ronald. The guy had pretended to work with them, then sold them out to Thacker. The two other kids on their team, Veronica and Joaquin, got killed as a result of the betrayal. He shook away the thoughts as the passage intersected a train tunnel. Gentry stopped with Locke, who dropped the bag on the ground.
There's a transport arriving at the next station in 2 hours. There are 3 maintenance uniforms in here, along with the appropriate IDs that have your pictures but have fake names. You'll need them to get on that train. Once you get to Kepler, another trooper will be waiting.
Chloe removed her helmet and walked over to the rucksack and pulled out the yellow maintenance outfits. She held up the largest of the uniforms as the rest of the rebel unit removed their helmets. Tig gave a shake of his head.
No way I'll fit in that.
You better, because you won't get on that train without it.
You got any gloves? And a hat?
Should be there. Check the bag.
She fished out both and handed them to Tig, then stood with a jumpsuit that was obviously a small. She looked about to the team.
A little privacy.
After the team had changed and Tig had squeezed into the jumpsuit, the ill-fitted engine turned to Chloe.
How do I look?
Chloe walked over as Ty put on the hat and then the gloves.
Not bad.
Cyrus grinned.
You don't want to know, Sergeant.
Yeah, whatever, man. Let's get moving.
Tig picked up his rifle, causing Locke to raise a hand.
Are you crazy? You have to pass as maintenance workers.
You want us to go there unarmed?
Maintenance workers don't carry pulse rifles, man. Now you either do as I say...
Tig tossed the gun onto his discarded pressure suit and armor.
Fine. I got arms. That's all I need.
He walked past Locke and headed down the train platform towards the maintenance gate and the ledge into the train tunnel. Tig was done chatting and didn't want to watch another goodbye between Keanu and Chloe. A few minutes later, Chloe and Cyrus joined him. The three of them made their way down the tracks until they got to the next station. Tig snuck a glance around the bend. A single trooper patrolled a near stairwell across the platform about 500 feet away. When the soldier turned his back, Tig motioned for Cyrus and Chloe. He helped them both up onto the platform.
Hey, what are you doing here?
Tig stood and stiffened, but Chloe gestured subtly with a finger to stand down.
We just got back from a track maintenance. You didn't get the message?
The soldier strode over, looking at them in turn.
Message? I didn't get any message about maintenance work.
Chloe shook her head.
It's the interference because of the damn tunnels. I'll check with the line supervisor and let them know.
Tig clenched his jaw, ready to spring into action if needed. He looked for cameras but didn't see any within view. The security down here was lacking, that was for sure. Good for them now, but bad if the machines invaded.
IDs.
Chloe fished hers out from her vest while Tig and Cyrus followed suit.
We're on the next train to Kepler for our first leave in 2 weeks. Can't wait to get back.
The trooper looked at the IDs one by one and then directed his gaze at Tig. The trooper looked again at the IDs, then handed them back.
Leave sounds damn good to me right now. Enjoy it.
He turned and walked away, vanishing around a pillar and into a hallway.
Nice job.
Tig nodded at Chloe, who smiled proudly.
Hope it's this easy when we get to Kepler.
Kinda hoping it won't be, to be honest. I'm ready to crack some skulls.
Akira walked through the systems of tunnels with Kichiro and Okami, still following IG and his comrades. Another 3 hours had passed since they jumped into the pool of water to escape the anaconda of metal and human faces. For some reason, the nightmare machine didn't follow them. Akira wondered if that was what had gotten the two deep-sea diving droids that went offline shortly after he made it to the crater. Questions swirled through his mind during the trek, not only about what his guides called the Conda, but how they survived out here with that mechanical beast hunting in these tunnels. Hina threw Akira a glance.
Almost there.
IG shined his flashlight on Akira.
We're good now. Prepare to meet the King of Tokyo, so mind your manners, Captain.
He stepped around the corner.
It's IG.
A heavy metal clank echoed past him, followed by the heavy thud of boots.
Come out!
IG raised his hands.
We have a visitor.
Akira kept his rifle cradled, but moved into a defensive stance. Okami and Kijiro both remained behind him. Two figures walked around the corridor. Both men directed suppressed assault rifles at Akira. Long black trench coats hung to their boots. The bulk under those coats told Akira they were wearing armor.
なんてこと?
Easy. I'm not here to harm anyone.
Only one of the men lowered his weapon halfway.
Well, I'll be damned. Never thought I'd see an engine again.
The other guard kept his rifle aimed at Akira. IG took refuge behind the guards. Lee joined him, but Hina stayed by Akira's side.
He's not an enemy. Found that out the hard way.
It's true.
The two guards finally lowered their rifles.
Thank you.
Akira let out a whistle and walked forward, both guards backing out of the way to let him pass as Kichiro and Okami followed, catching glares from the guards. Around the corner, two sentry guns were positioned on the sides of a steel door. They both roved toward his droids. Those weapons would make quick work of them if this was a trap, but he didn't have a choice now. These people might be his best shot at finding the life arc and appearing. Two blast doors creaked open, revealing a vast chamber. A pair of Hummer droids waited inside, their robotic arms mounted with plasma rifles. These were archaic models, which was probably why the signals sent on E-Day didn't turn them. Or perhaps these people had reprogrammed them like Juno had Blinky. Behind the robots, two Doberman Pinscher droids watched Akira, their artificial black eyes following his every movement. They growled at Okami, and the wolf dog returned the gesture.
Easy.
Okami quieted, but the other dog droids continued to snarl. Akira walked through the blast doors and onto the bottom floor of the chamber. Rising up from the floor, 10 levels of platforms extended all the way to the cracked concrete ceiling. Haphazardly built shacks filled every level. Water dripped from the ceiling in an almost constant stream. On the ground level, tents and more metal shacks provided refuge from the dripping water. Faces poked out, some wearing masks, others with scarves up over their noses, their eyes following him in awe.
An engine! They found an engine!
A group of 10 people surrounded Akira and his animal companions. Then 20. Within minutes, there were 50 people surging around him. Okami wagged his tail, but Kichiro let out a neigh, clearly agitated by the presence of so many people. There were survivors of all ages, even a few elderly. Akira heard a baby wail and looked up to a woman trying to comfort a child in one of the upper-level shacks. Curtains covering the windows of the dwellings on the platforms above pulled back, and filthy faces peered down at Akira. He looked right back, just as in awe of them as they were of him. In his heart, he believed there would be survivors outside the megacities, but he never imagined he would find them under one, except for maybe in the Life Arc. Akira looked at his mission clock. He was now 8 hours in and needed to get moving.
What the hell is all the commotion about?
The two guards leading Akira both went down on one knee as a man wearing a leather vest strode into view. Tattoos covered his arms and neck. His voice was familiar, but it was his rough and handsome face that told Akira he was the leader of the Yakuza gang he encountered the night of E-Day. By his side was the same brown Hummer droid, a smile on his screen.
Ah, would you believe it? Akira the Brave has returned.
No! I don't fucking believe it.
Never thought I'd see your ugly mug again. But perhaps you've returned to help as you promised the night of the Holocaust.
He stepped up to Akira. The engine towered a foot and a half above the Yakuza gangster, but the man didn't back down.
Kobe.
Not anymore, motherfucker.
Kobe raised his tattooed arms and turned to face the people.
What's my name?
King of Tokyo! King of Tokyo!
Cheers and shouts roared through the chamber. The Hummer droid joined in by stomping a metal padded foot. Kobe then raised a hand to quiet the crowd.
I didn't think the military was still fighting up there. Where are the rest of you assholes? We've been waiting over a month for some sort of action topside.
It's just me.
You came alone?
I did.
You gotta be kidding.
Hina stepped up, coming around from behind Akira.
It's true.
I see you met my cousin.
Kobe then narrowed his eyes and studied her face.
Damn, kid, what happened to your nose?
Hina slow blinked and then canted her head towards Akira.
He happened.
Kobe glanced from his cousin to Akira, his nostrils flared with anger.
You hit a girl? My cousin?
They attacked me and my droids. She's lucky to be alive.
Kobe seemed to consider that for a moment, then seemed to soften.
Yeah, I get it. With what the world's turned into, you gotta shoot first, ask questions later.
He pointed at Hina.
You're the dumbass that attacked an engine.
His gaze went to IG and Lee.
Seriously, what were you thinking? And what were you doing on the surface anyways?
Scavenging. Until we saw him heading for the downed King Cobra.
I told you not to go topside for a while. It's too dangerous right now, especially with all the activity.
Kobe ran a hand over his buzzed head and turned back to Akira.
So, what are you doing here?
I came to find the Life Arc buried under the city.
A wave of murmurs spread through the survivors.
Can we talk somewhere private?
Sure. Follow me, Akira the Brave. But, leave your friends.
Akira hesitated.
They'll be fine. You have my word.
Your cousin and her comrades were going to part them out.
Kobe glared at Hina.
Is that so?
Hina shrugged.
Stay here and make sure they don't get a scratch or it's your rations.
Hina's face fell into a scowl.
Okay.
Akira gave Kichiro and Okami orders to stay put before following Kobe and his droid. The crowd parted as hushed voices filled the chamber while they left. Kobe took an open door that connected to a second, much smaller open chamber. Inside, tiered levels were packed full of troughs under grow lights. All sorts of plants grew under them, most of them just starting to bloom. They then passed livestock that lived in dark stalls down offshoot hallways. Kobe took him into a large office with desks pushed against the windowless walls, a table in the center of the room covered in maps. The robot walked in with them and closed the door. Kobe turned and canted his head at the robot.
Oh, by the way, this is Fish, if you don't remember.
Akira scrutinized the droid.
The fuck you looking at?
A grin crawled across Kobe's face.
He's programmed to be a gigantic asshole.
Now that's a picture.
Look, I don't have much time. I'm looking for a life arc and need your help. This is the first time I've run into those snakes out there, and I have a feeling there are more.
Kobe took a seat at the main table and propped his feet up on it, then put his hands behind his head.
We call them anacondas. You've probably heard my cousin calling them condas for short. After the machines left Tokyo, they dropped those suckers on us. I'm guessing to clear out the survivors. Real bag of dicks they are.
And they haven't found this place yet.
God willing they won't.
How do you stay hidden from them?
Mostly we just keep to ourselves. We lost a few people to them back when we were sending more scavenging parties out.
No one goes out anymore.
Besides my shithead cousin and the little crew she runs with, no. We're holed up here tighter than a crab trying to save its ass from an octopus.
He reached into his vest and pulled out a small vial and held it up under the light.
When we do risk sending a scavenger up, they take one of these. If they get captured, they commit, what do the samurai call it?
Seppuku.
Right. Except they don't cut out their own bellies like the samurai did, or whatever. But still, death by poison is better than what the machines do to them.
Akira walked over to the maps, many of which were hand-drawn. Kobe pointed to a spot on one larger map at the center of the table.
We're here, if you can't tell. Right on the other side of the crater, in the basement of an old warehouse built under a scraper. Those silos you saw once held chemicals. We patched them up the best we could and have started to grow food for the long haul. But I don't know if it'll be enough.
Akira didn't want to say he agreed. Food would only prolong the inevitable, but eventually those condas would find this place.
I need to find the life arc. Do you have a map showing where it is?
What's in it for me?
What do you want?
Kobe scratched his chin.
Supplies and food are nice, but really, we want out of this shithole. Preferably somewhere safe from the machines. I'm sure the military has some bunker somewhere with endless supplies, right?
We have a sanctuary, but our supplies are far from endless. How many of you are there?
105 as of this morning. And I'm not going to tell you where the life arc is unless I get an assurance you will evacuate every single one of them, even Grandma Bebop and her dentures.
So you do know?
Kobe smirked.
Yeah, pal, I know.
Akira took in a deep breath as he looked over the maps again. Sagami Bay was only 2 miles to the south. Under normal circumstances, it wasn't much ground to cover, but with the condas, it may as well have been 200 miles. There was plenty of room on the Pelican for Kobe's people if Akira could somehow get them there safely, but it was a big risk to the people and the submarine. Still, without a Piran, the war was lost and everyone would die anyway.
Before we agree to anything, have you been to the Life Arc?
No, I haven't. And before you ask, my people haven't either. We know where the entrances are, but from what I understand, they were sealed off. We were thinking of raiding it if we ran out of food and didn't have any better choice.
Akira thought for a moment.
Very well. If you tell me where the Life Arc is, I will help get your people out of here as soon as I can. I still owe you from the last time we met.
That's right, you do. But before I agree to anything, I want to know where you're taking us.
You want me to trust that you'll keep your end of the bargain? Well, you're going to have to trust me on the location.
Shit.
Kobe folded his arms across his vest.
You just admitted you owe me, Captain. And frankly, you owe it to these people to help them. After all, it was the Nova Alliance that caused their suffering, am I right?
I really will do everything I can to get them to safety.
I have your word?
Yes.
All right, then. I'll help keep you alive long enough to fulfill that promise.
He unfolded his arms and snapped his fingers at the droid.
Let's go, Fish. We got some fishing to do.
Jackson felt a wave of nausea when he came to. He forced his heavy eyelids open and blinked away the blur to find he was in a glass and metal pod inside a shaft of metal bones. Hundreds of other chambers lined the alloy spinal columns all around Jackson. Rays of moonlight filtered in from a gaping hole in the side of the skeletal space far above his pod. It struck him that he was inside one of the superstructures, maybe even in the one he had disabled, judging by the damage to the upper levels and the hole that was letting in the moonlight. The pod glass began to open, cold air blasting his naked body. Straps over his chest and legs held him in place. He reached around to find a way to free himself and fell down to a tube twisting from a port in his stomach. A sudden bright glow appeared in the darkness, forcing the shadows to retreat. The light weakened until Jackson could make out the light was a floating hologram of a figure dressed in a silver coat.
Cross?
Jackson stared at the hologram of the AI that had nearly wiped out humanity.
I wasn't expecting to find another one of your kind, and yet here you are, alive and in remarkably good condition.
The hologram hovered over the open pod, eyes flitting from Jackson's feet to his mohawk.
You are an engine, are you not?
Jackson didn't reply.
At first, I thought you were a breaker, dressed in coalition armor, but your flesh lacks the tattoos of my former super soldiers. So that tells me you have allied with traitorous coalition forces in this area. Those fools that have broken their allegiance to me will suffer greatly when my legions hunt them down.
The hologram shifted directly over Jackson's face.
Now, I will only ask this once. Name, rank, unit. I want to know more about the soldier that brought down one of my harvesters.
Jackson wanted to fire back and tell Dr. Cross what he really thought of him, but he was a prisoner of war. Part of his training as an engine told him silence was the best route during an interrogation. But that was back when the army was flesh and blood.
You will answer my questions. Trust me on that.
Humming rose through the hollowed interior of the superstructure that Dr. Cross called a harvester. A drone flew over and hovered over Jackson. A small hole opened in the bottom of the drone, ejecting a glob of a tar-like substance directly onto his face and chest. Jackson closed his eyes, but some of the thick goo had already gotten in his eyes. A burning sensation instantly set in. He tried to blink out the liquid, but it quickly dissolved. When his vision cleared, he saw the gelatinous material had completely soaked into his chest, too. Squirming in his thick hair were black worms.
Like I said, you will talk.
The worms slithered off his ribs and down his body in all directions, their eyeless faces opening to reveal needle-like teeth that chiseled through his flesh with ease. One worm wiggled across his lips. He clamped his jaw, catching it before it could get all the way into his mouth. Jackson bit down as hard as he could. Fluid sloshed in his mouth when he split through the thick, chewy body of the worm.
I wouldn't swallow that. It's poisonous in large doses.
Jackson spit out the meaty body and kept spitting until his mouth was dry. He jerked and flinched as the worms chewed into his flesh and under his skin. The pain was overwhelming, like 1,000 tiny knives were stabbing and digging into him all at once.
I can make them stop. All you have to do is tell me what I want to know.
Jackson tried to break free from his restraints, his muscles tightening against his body.
I'm sure you have heard of my offer to join my legions willingly, to live in this new world. Why must it be so hard? Why must you fight the future?
Jackson closed his eyes as one of the worms writhed around his genitals.
You can end this!
Fuck you!
The hologram of Dr. Cross smiled.
You found your voice. I knew it wouldn't be hard to break you.
You won't break me. You'll never break me.
It might take longer than the others, but I have my ways.
The holographic image of the doctor again leaned down over his sweaty body.
Just tell me your name, rank, and unit. All this can end.
Jackson glanced down at the worms buried under his skin. They weren't moving now. Part of him wanted to submit, but he knew once he did, it would open the floodgates to more questions.
No? Okay. Let's try something else.
The hologram floated across the middle of the chamber to the skeletal risers. A white glow lit up each pod along the levels, illuminating the prisoners inside. Despite what Jackson had expected, not all were full of intact humans. Headless, limbless torsos floated in clear liquid, cords hooked to the flesh. In one pod, all Jackson saw was a head and a neck with a spinal cord. The eyes and the head suddenly moved. Jackson squinted, unbelieving until he saw the remains of a bandage around the partially burned face. It was the fisherman, and he was still alive.
No. No, oh God, oh... No.
These are the people that refused my offers to transcend. I took what I needed from them, and now they will remain like this.
The hologram of the AI drifted back to Jackson. Jackson forced his gaze away from the fisherman to a metal platform. Another hologram started to appear in his field of vision. It was a human man, and the face Jackson recognized right away. Captain Akira Hayashi.
You will tell me where Captain Hayashi and the others are hiding.
The hologram of Dr. Cross pointed at the fisherman.
You know what will happen if you don't.
Jackson looked at the spinal cord connected to a head across the chamber.
Tell me where Captain Hayashi is hiding.
Jackson closed his eyes. Silence was his answer. Cross shook his head.
You must like pain. Okay, let's see how long you last.
A deep rumble cut off the AI. Otto looked upward as the rumbling intensified, shaking the entire chamber. Glancing up, Jackson saw the Coalition shuttle launching into the sky.
Go, go.
An interesting turn of events. A shuttle packed full of survivors that have turned down my offer of transcendence.
The roar outside of the shuttle reverberated through the tower. The hologram looked back to Jackson.
I could blast that ship to pieces, but you know what? Maybe I'll let them live. Maybe I'll let them land on the moon.
Cross hovered closer to the pod.
Yes, I think that's exactly what I'll do. I'll let those refugees explain to the LDC what's happening on Earth. So when my armies land on the moon, they know they have only one chance to surrender.
He offered a casual shrug.
In the meantime, you and I will have plenty of time to chat.
The AI snapped his fingers, activating the worms that curled under Jackson's skin. The members of Ronan's platoon stood before the bunker door out to the regolith as Sergeant Slaner eyed the cadets.
We're headed out to Zone 3. This will be your first live fire drill, so make sure you get your head on straight during the ride. Secure your helmets and be ready to fall out.
There was a platoon's worth of helmets being secured and suits being sealed as the cadets lined up for the drill. Once ready, Slaner gave a gesture to another man in a control booth. The bunker door opened in front of the platoon.
Platoon, fall out!
Ronan trotted across a basin with the other 28 members of the Machine Slayers. Each young trooper cradled a plasma rifle, wore vacuum-rated suits under their armor, and sported battery-powered exoskeletons, kept them moving with ease across the dust. As Ronan trekked out into the moon dust, he tried not to think about the dream he had had the night before. The platoon moved away from the base and the glow of research lights straight into the darkness of the basin. It wasn't long before three transport rovers came into view. The bulky mining rigs had been retrofitted with troop carriers, with mounted turrets over the front and rear of the vehicle. Three troopers held sentry at the back. They opened the hatches as the platoon approached. The cadets climbed inside of a spacious interior with 10 bucket seats. Everyone racked their weapons and got into seats. Ronan took one between Mickey and Bradley. When they were all secured, the trooper assigned to the transport closed the hatch. The rover jerked and the oversized tires churned over the basin as Bradley turned to look to Ronan and Mickey.
I wonder why they're shipping us off for this drill. Who cares? I'm just excited to finally shoot my rifle.
They probably don't want us hitting the base by accident, so I'm assuming they're shipping us off because some of us can't shoot in a straight line.
Mickey turned toward him.
What's that supposed to mean?
Not aimed at you. Relax.
The rover thumped over rocky terrain, telling Ronan that they were already off the basin. He couldn't see the moon's surface to confirm his suspicions because the transport didn't have any viewports. But he watched the minimap on his HUD. The convoy inched closer to Zone 3. Craters pockmarked the area.
All right, listen up. Once we unload, it's a short march to our firing zone. Stay in combat intervals at all times. Listen to everything I say. Got it?
A short while later, the rover jolted to a stop, and the trooper assigned to the vehicle opened the hatch again. He motioned for the cadets to hop out. Ronan and the rest of the platoon gathered around Zlaner outside. A fourth vehicle, this one a four-person tactical rover, headed toward their location. There was a single passenger with the driver. The rover halted behind the vehicles, and out hopped platoon lieutenant Ariana Ortiz, wearing gray armor with gold stripes on her shoulder pads. An open channel alert sounded.
Okay, machine slayers! Your training today is on the other side of that crater rim. Let's move!
She led the way up toward the raised crater rim, moving at a clip. The rest of the platoon slowly made their way up like ants on a hill. At the crest, they had a view of the crater 50 feet at its deepest point and almost a quarter mile across. But this wasn't a normal crater. This one was a gravesite.
Holy crap! Are those Hummer droids?
Sticking out of the sloped crater rim were former mining droids. Limbs, torsos, and heads protruded from the ground. The LDC had dumped them in craters like this on and after E-Day. Ronan felt a blast of raw fear at the sight of so many droids and no way of knowing if any were functional. Judging from the way the rest of the platoon was staring at the broken machines, he wasn't alone in his feelings. Ronan knew that this was part of their training, the LDC wanting to see how they'd react. Mickey started down the other side of the mound as Ortiz waved them onward. The lieutenant walked down into the darkness, her helmet light serving as a beacon. The farther they descended into the crater, the darker it became. Beams flitted outward from rifles and helmets to guide the cadets. Ronan moved carefully, not trying to slide, and noticed tracks from boots along with tire marks as they were coming up on the bottom of the crater. Bradley was almost to the bottom, just behind Ortiz. One of the guiding beams of light suddenly shot spaceward. Ronan looked to find Bradley had fallen. He pushed himself and aimed his rifle back at what had tripped him.
Easy, cadet.
Bradley illuminated a bulky Hummer droid standing upright in the dust. All across the basin, the droids were positioned upright, utilizing poles and supports. Standing almost 8 feet tall, the menacing metal monsters almost looked like they were still functional.
All right, listen up. These are your targets. Remember, you're using live ammo, so watch your firing zones. Sergeant, split them up into squads.
Ronan ended up in a squad with Bradley, Mickey, and three other cadets.
Ronan, you're a squad leader.
Figures.
Bradley nodded at Ronan.
I trust you. Thanks.
It was an honor being given a squad, but also a new challenge. Ronan thought back to what Tig had said about counting on your comrades in battle, then tried to put the engine out of his mind. The different firing lanes were marked by poles with glowing numbers. Three droids had been erected at 25, 50, 75, and 100 meters away. The facial screens were all offline, which made them look even more menacing without their friendly smiles.
Mickey, you're up first.
Mickey stepped up to the line in the dust, shouldered his rifle, and fired on the closest machine. Ronan and the rest of the squad kept behind him, watching the bolt streak across the darkness. Dust kicked up where the rounds slammed into the ground around the Hummer droid. None of his first six shots found the target. The squad comm surged to life.
If you can't shoot these when they're standing still, the hell are you gonna do when they're moving?
Cut the shit. Mickey, try again and steady your rifle. I know what I'm doing!
This time he fired with the stock more secure against his shoulder plate. Several of the bolts slammed into the torso of the droid. He fired a series of other bursts. Each burst got better, scoring several hits on each of the machines.
Good job. I'll go next.
Ronan raised his rifle, gripped it under the barrel, and lined up the sights. Moving his finger toward the trigger, he prepared to pull it when fragmented memories from E-Day surfaced in his mind. His father staying behind, then of being trapped in the hangar, and finally, Zachary. Ronan turned off comms just before he fired his first burst. The bolts chiseled into the center of the droid's face, blowing off its alloy jaw. He swiveled his barrel to the target at 50 meters, lined up the sights, and fired again. This time, the bolts hammered into the T section of the chest. He moved on to the droid 75 meters out. Every shot hit home, drilling through the alloy. Finally, Ronan lined up the sights on the target at 100 meters. Just like before, each bolt streaked into the enemy. He lowered his rifle and reopened comms.
Nice shooting, Ronan. Damn, you nearly took the face off the first one.
All across the basin, the other squads fired on the machines. Cadets getting their first taste of shooting on the lunar surface. A priority alert sounded over the main comms.
All squads, return to the rigs. Repeat, all squads, return to rigs.
The cadets all looked to Ronan.
You heard her, on me.
They started the trek back to the rim, moving fast. Mickey threw a glance to Ronan.
Is this another test?
Don't know.
Ronan saw that some cadets had stopped and were looking back over the crater they were leaving behind. Ronan glanced in that direction, following their gaze.
Three King Cobra space planes raced across the black.
They banked away, headed out toward Kepler Station. His heart pounded as he made his way up. This wasn't a test. It was just like his dream. He moved as fast as he could as he thought of Elan and their mother. Once he crested the crater, the vehicles were still there. He used his HUD to figure out which direction Kepler Station was located and then turned in that direction, seeing nothing in the black. Ronan then spotted Sergeant Zlaner waving cadets into the waiting rovers.
Sergeant Zlaner, do you know what's going on?
The sergeant didn't reply, but Ortiz did.
There's a shuttle heading towards Kepler. It escapes Earth, and command wants all hands on deck, just in case this is a trap.